Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service.
The podcast exploring the minds, the motives and the money of some of the world's richest individuals.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up in the programme. An important day in the US and in particular for millions of people struggling to afford vital healthcare medication.
It's quite significant for older adults in the U.S. who are covered by the Medicare program, in particular for the prescription drug benefit. There are about 54 million people on that benefit.
We'll tell you why those drug prices are going to drop significantly. And we're looking at the growing popularity even of food halls, food courts, whatever you want to call them. That's coming up a little bit later in the program. But we're going to start in Sweden.
Vi har också nu under eftermiddagen fått bekräftat att vi har...
That is Sweden's Health and Social Affairs Minister Jakob Formstedt confirming the first case of the new and more dangerous Mpox variant outside Africa. The infected person is in the Stockholm area and has recently returned from a trip to Africa. Earlier, the World Health Organization declared Mpox a public health emergency of international concern. The disease has spread rapidly in Africa since the beginning of the year. The WHO head is Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
The emergency committee met and advised me that, in its view, the situation constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. I have accepted that advice. In addition to other outbreaks of other clades of Mpox in other parts of Africa, it's clear that a coordinated international response is essential to stop these outbreaks and save lives.
Clearly, if the fight against the disease is to be successful, there will have to be a huge increase in vaccine production. So, a little earlier, I spoke to Paul Chaplin of the drug manufacturer Bavarian Nordic. They are the main producer of the Mpox vaccine.
The vaccine has been developed in collaboration with the US government, and actually before 2022, when we had the last outbreak, we manufactured to order. So when governments wanted to place an order, we would manufacture obviously to that order, and that's how we had it. So we had no real inventory. 22 was a bit of a wake-up call in that we did actually manage to supply all the demand that came in. We made 15 million doses and supplied more than 76 countries around the world. But what we've done subsequently is that we have a rolling inventory. So there is vaccine inventory available, allowing us a surge capacity for these sort of outbreak situations. Now, depending on the outbreak, depends on how many doses were deficient. Until a few weeks ago, had 500,000 doses. We can supply in total an additional around about 2 million doses this year on top of everything else we're already doing. And by the end of next year, in addition to our order book, we could supply up to another 10 million.
Those are big numbers, aren't they? But when we look at the situation in Africa, the challenge at the moment is there isn't enough vaccine available. They need 10 million doses by the end of this year, don't they?
Well, the African CDC mentioned they need 2-3 million this year, but 10 million in total. But of course, that's Africa. Unfortunately, the first case of this new variant has also now been reported in Sweden. So we feel a little bit like we're back in 2022 at the beginning of the outbreak, and that we're going to need to try and make sure that our vaccine supply is sufficient. We're already looking at ways of scaling up and maybe involving other manufacturers to increase capacity. Having said all that, the situation in Africa has been evident the whole of this year, and we've been in dialogue with the WHO, with African CDC, with Gavi all year. And the only dose order that we've received is the recent order from HERA, where they ordered 175,000 doses. So while there's a lot of speculation and a lot of concern, quite frankly, apart from media, no one is really contacting us for doses.
Why do you think that is the case? Is it the cost of the drug that puts off governments in Africa?
I would say at the beginning of the year, our product was not approved in Africa. So it's approved in Europe, US, Canada, and other parts of the world. But there are no approvals in Africa. Until the vaccine is approved in some way, you can't actually distribute or donate the vaccine. So in both Nigeria and the DRC, we now have what is called an emergency use authorization, allowing our vaccine to be used. For the DRC, that's only happened in the last month. And that has paved the way now for other nations to make donations or for more acquisitions to be made in those two countries. Now, of course, it's spreading into other countries where currently, as of today, our product is not approved. So we need to find and work with the regulators on how quickly we can get those approvals in place so that vaccine can be distributed in those territories as well. We realise we are part of the solution, but we are not the solution, to be honest.
Paul Chaplin there, the CEO of the drug manufacturer Bavaria Nordic. Let's bring in Tom Hayes, chairman of Great Hill Capital in New York. I'm just looking at a graph of Bavarian Nordic's share price, up over 26% in 5 days. And I suppose that's a reminder of what happened in the pandemic, Tom, isn't it? That difficult times for many people, but for some pharmaceutical companies, it can lead to a lot of growth.
Yeah, there's no question about it. You definitely get the pop on the approval. The question is the durability of that pop being sustained. We all remember Pfizer coming out with the first vaccine for COVID and the stock had a huge run. Now it can't get out of its own way for the last few years. Same thing with Moderna was going to change the world. And it was the hottest flying stock during COVID. And it's since collapsed and is trying to find its way. So this is all good news. Anytime you have constructive, efficacious drugs that are approved to help people, it's a positive thing. But as far as durability, you have to measure it over time.
Yep. Let us see what happens there. To the US now, because the White House says it's negotiating a big cut in the price of some key medicines. The deal was reached with big pharmaceutical companies and covers 10 key medicines for conditions, including diabetes and also heart failure. Here's President Biden making the announcement at an election campaign event in Maryland.
This is a fight all of us have been fighting for a long time, taking on Big Pharma. We pay more for prescription drugs. It's not hyperbole. We pay more for prescription drugs than any advanced nation in the world. I could take out an Air Force One, and if you have a prescription from a drug company in America, and fly you to Toronto, Canada, fly you to Paris, France, fly you to Belfast, anywhere around the world, and get you the same prescription filled from the same company for 40 to 60% less than we pay for it here.
Now, the U.S. government says the deal will save Americans $7.5 billion in its first year. Some of the world's biggest medicines made by leading drug companies, well, they could see their prices cut in the U.S. by between 38 and 79%. So significant numbers there. For more on this, I've been speaking to Stacey Dusatzina, a health policy professor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, about how the U.S. government has finally been able to achieve such a deal.
It's quite significant for older adults in the U.S. who are covered by the Medicare program. In particular, for people who are on Medicare Part D, the prescription drug benefit, there are about 54 million people on that benefit. It really is a significant moment. In particular, when the Part D benefit was first designed, there was a clause in the law that made it illegal for the government to negotiate prices all together as one entity. And so even though there are only 10 drugs that are being negotiated, it is quite historic for the U.S. to be taking this particular step.
Why was that the case? A lot of people listening to this will not understand that. Why was the federal government not allowed to negotiate directly with the drug companies?
When the Part D plans were first set up, the goal was to have that part of the Medicare benefit operated by private plans. And the idea was that the private plans would be able to engage with negotiations through pharmacy benefits managers to try to lower prices and, in theory, could do a lot to compete with prices and get lower costs for the people on the Medicare program. It is kind of interesting when you talk about not being allowed to negotiate for a program that's paid for by taxpayers, it's probably good reason that people listening to this might think that that doesn't sound like a great idea. A lot of people disagreed with that approach from the beginning, and it's just taken a long time to change the law so that there was an opportunity to negotiate across all Part D plans.
Because some of the savings on the drugs, and they are still expensive, I'm looking at here, a blood thinner from Johnson & Johnson was $517 and is now $117 on the price. That is just through negotiation. The government's not subsidizing any of these drugs.
That's partially correct. Although one of the complicating factors when looking at those price differences, when you're looking at that high price that was the prior listed price, it doesn't include negotiations that might have already been happening with pharmacy benefits managers and plans that are running the Part D benefit today. So for a lot of the drugs on the list, we know that they got really steep discounts and rebates that were going on behind the scenes. But they're secret, so no one knows what that price is. The government knows what that price ultimately was. But it makes it difficult to compare when we look at those price reductions that are shown. That's probably not the real savings to the government. The good news is that the government has provided an estimate of how much real savings there would have been. So if we took those new prices and replaced our old prices with those, the net savings after considering all of those secret rebates and discounts would have been about 22%. So there's still a pretty substantial savings that is going to occur. It's just not quite as shocking as it looks when you compare those list prices to the new prices.
But this isn't something I presume that the drug companies are going to be particularly happy about. They are going to lose some of their revenue here, aren't they?
There will be some revenue loss, although it's really important to recognize that another part of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the law that included price negotiation, also expands the generosity of the Medicare benefit to make it easier for people to afford their medicines and potentially to fill more prescriptions. And the other thing that happens for these 10 drugs that were selected for negotiation, they automatically will be included on Medicare formularies. So today what can happen is that a formulary can decide to leave one of these drugs off in place of their competitors. So if your drug was selected for negotiation, yes, your price will be negotiated, but you'll now have access to all of the Medicare formularies. So it's a little too early to tell if this is even going to be bad for the bottom line. It might actually mean that more people are able to fill the medicine to the extent they can maybe potentially keep their profits or potentially even sell more prescription drugs and maybe have a little bit of a bump in profits.
Stacey Doucette, Zina, there on that fall in US drug prices. Tom Hayes still with us. We had some important figures out, didn't we, today, Tom, on US retail sales. What did they tell us?
Well, when the music is playing, you have to get up and dance. And that's what we saw in the US stock market today after the retail sales numbers came in, up 1% month on month versus 0.4% estimated, and negative 0.2% last time we got that number. And year on year, retail sales were up 2.66% versus 2.04% the last time. Why is this so important? It's important because people were worried that we were going toward a hard landing after the jobs report this month and some of the inflation numbers showing slowing. So it shows that the retail consumer is still alive. But not so alive that the Fed is not going to cut. So it's the best of both worlds. We got Goldilocks numbers today for sure.
Okay. And, you know, that Fed cut, if it happens in September, the U.S. Central Bank cutting interest rates there, is it going to be 0.25% or 0.5%?
Well, the million-dollar question. It should be 0.5%. They're 200 basis points too restrictive, meaning the Fed funds rate is 5.3 and change. Inflation is about 3%, so they're over 200 basis points too restrictive. They should go 50. They're probably going to go 25 just to get it started. They probably don't want to shock things right before the election as well with the political considerations. Mm-hmm. The key is to get started. They can always ramp it up in December.
Tom, thanks very much for that.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at Ukraine's surprise attack on Russian territory. Thousands of Russian residents have been forced to flee their homes as Ukrainian forces edge closer and closer into Russia. Could this bold gamble shift the dynamics of this war? Or could it backfire? The Global Story podcast brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You're with World Business Report here from the BBC World Service. Let's take you now to Kolkata in eastern India, where there have been large protests, huge protests, following the rape and murder last week of a 31-year-old female doctor in Kolkata. Thousands of people have been out on the streets. It has once again also led to concerns about the safety of women in the workplace. Dr. Sujata Dutta is a gynecologist in Kolkata who joined the protest.
I did take to the streets yesterday in a protest rally. It happened very spontaneously in Kolkata last night. And when I went out there, I saw hundreds and thousands of people, young, old, men, women, children, people with frailties, you know, all out on the streets, all asking for one thing. And that was bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice, you know, really asking for justice for this horrible rape and murder that's happened to a woman postgraduate trainee in the middle of the night on duty within her workplace, a place that should have given her security, a place that she should have been able to.
You very eloquently expressed, I think, a lot of the anger that many people are feeling in Kolkata and across parts of India as well. As a doctor, do you now worry, or have you been worried for some time, about your own safety in the workplace?
Well, this is not the first time that things like this have happened. It's not only safety of women in the work. There has been a lot of violence against doctors, especially in the government hospitals where, you know, unruly mobs, irate at what, you know, patient outcome or whatever, various reasons have attacked doctors and brutalized and vandalized property, which has again happened after this incident. And yes, we are worried. There have been protests before led by the student community in the medical colleges asking for safety, asking for security at the workplace. This is not an isolated incident. We keep seeing this happening over and over again. And yes, we are really worried about our safety.
Do you fear that that actually may put some people off from joining the profession? India has a huge population. It needs many, many doctors. Do you think when people see that level of violence and cases like this, the one that we've seen in Kolkata, it may lead some people to say, look, I don't want to enter this profession?
I think it's happened already. The best students, when, you know, we were entering medical colleges, it was the best students that would come into medicine. It was difficult. It was competitive exams. You had to put in a lot of years, effort, and you would have to excel in your field really passionately, love what you wanted to do, want to make a difference to society, have an impact. All of these reasons, you know, brought us to the profession that we're in now. But unfortunately, things have changed over the years, and because of violence in the workplace. And there have been lots and lots of reasons why people have felt really frustrated, demoralized. I'm afraid there are not a lot of people coming into medicine anymore. I mean, certainly not as many as we need.
We can hear the despondency in your voice as well. Do you think things are going to change?
Well, we can only hope for the best. And that is why everybody's taken to the streets. Everybody's agitating. One hopes that the authorities would listen to us and wake up. There will be systems put in place so that this doesn't happen anymore and the system gradually changes. We're just hoping that somebody will listen.
Sujata Dutta there, doctor in Kolkata. Now, India has a problem that it needs more women to enter the workplace, but participation rates are very low. They're at about 30%, much lower than other major economies when it comes to women in the workplace. Rohini Pandey is a professor of economics and the director of the Economic Growth Center at Yale University. She's currently in Delhi.
I think we often think of public safety in quite a paternalistic way, that, you know, women need to be kept safe. They should be provided facilities that will keep them away from potential perpetrators, typically men, rather than asking how do we ensure that men do not have the ability to be able to exert such influence. And that's not going to come by segregating women. In fact, women typically are the most unsafe when there are spaces identified which are spaces that they should be kept away from.
That is interesting, isn't it? Because I spend a lot of time in India, and there has been debate recently about should India have women-only factories in some instances. We had an airline recently that said women could sit together. There would be women-only spaces on their planes. Do you not think that helped?
I think what that misses out is, you know, it's not every woman who is going to get victimized. It's a woman who is alone and doesn't have resources. And you're never going to create a society where you're going to completely segregate. So take the case of metros. Pretty much every Indian metro will have one carriage, which is women's only. But we have recent evidence from researchers who looked at this in Brazil, which had the same policy, and it showed that actually any safety gains for women from a women's only metro were undone by the harassment costs faced by a woman who jumped onto metro at the last minute and ended up in a carriage, which wasn't a woman's only carriage. So I think it's a losing battle to try to create these women-only spaces. I think what we need to do is really to ask is, why are we ending up in a society where some set of men feel that this is okay?
This has huge social implications for India. It also has economic implications as well. If women don't feel safe in a workspace, that means they may be less likely to go into that workspace. And there are not enough women working within the Indian economy already, are there?
There's definitely not enough women working in the Indian economy. So that I completely agree with. I think you have to recognize that women often are still willing to go to places that are unsafe, because one of the ways they realize in the longer run they're safer or more independent is actually by having a job and having money. You know, many women are in households where they face dangers in those households. So the choice is often not that women are choosing to not leave the house. It's that others now have reason to get them to not leave the house. And a lot of it is completely understandable. You're a parent of a daughter, you hear all these stories and your kind of paternalistic instinct is, my daughter should not go out. But that again is something, you know, that probably does more damage. And I have to say, I have rarely heard in all the surveys I've done women say, I don't want to work because it's unsafe. I think the real danger is it gives cover for people who don't want to see lots of women competing for jobs in a setting where there aren't a lot of jobs.
I was in India recently where I heard conversations like that where people would say, well, I don't think my daughter should go and work there because I think, and we're talking about men here often, that it's unsafe. Yeah. But how do you get around that then? Because that is a challenge that India has faced for a while and doesn't seem to be getting to grips with, or not getting to grips with as quickly as it should.
Well, I think the most important thing is to not use these kind of events to put in place these sort of paternalistic policies of keeping women, you know, protecting women. As I said, I think what we need to do is make the world a safe place. And that means addressing what's going wrong with a lot of young men or older men. And I think that discussion is rarely happening.
Rohini Pandey there, looking at the challenge of getting more women into the workplace. Let's move on now, because food halls are being used to increase the value of surrounding offices and apartments in cities and towns globally. Property investors have recognised the business value of a food hall in bringing footfall and spend to an area known as the halo effect. In the US, there are just under 400 food halls in operation, with a further 100 expected to open. Davina Gupta has been looking into the business of food halls.
It's lunchtime and I have come to a red stone building in Manchester in the north of England. It's a buzzing food hall called Society that offers a variety of cuisines. Italian, Korean, Indian and so much more. People are sitting around in groups trying to enjoy their drink and food, and I'm sure you can hear that constant chatter around me. In some countries you would call this a food court, but it's actually a food hall. So what's the difference?
Say a McDonald's or a...
That's Philip Kulikyo, a food hall consultant in the U.S.
We believe that a food court is most often associated with chain restaurants, whereas a food hall is designed specifically for artisanal brands, for smaller groups or groups that are sort of new to the scene.
So now that Philip has cleared the air on that one, what makes this concept so popular? Let's ask some customers in this Manchester City food hall.
They're our choice of places to go because it's a bit more open, a lot of trades for food and drinks. The perfect, really.
Like the fact that, yeah, you can order when you want as well, not just what you want. You know, someone who's not been here before can have a real look around and see what there is.
While many food halls have opened in big city centre locations, they've also been used as a redevelopment tool where local government or businesses want to bring more investment to an area.
Today is a classic, typical Danish summer day. A bit gloomy, windy, but still very warm.
This is Spiros Loukopoulos, General Manager of Refn in Copenhagen. It's located on an island connected to the main city by a road bridge. The area was originally a shipyard.
It was just a no man's land, let's call it.
That's still Spiros and his team got some food vendors together and used shipping containers as kitchen to open a food hall.
We had to make the infrastructure from zero. I can say that we have now 35 different kitchens from 17 different countries.
And all these kitchens,
yeah,
they operate from a similar container. How do they do that?
You can describe it as a medium truck, that much of a space. Of course, you can stand. And you have maybe 80 to 1 meter above your head. It's a box. It is a box.
Today, Refn is the largest food hall in Northern Europe, which has also become a busy tourist spot that attracts tens of thousands of customers each year. And other businesses wanted a piece of that action.
When Refn came here, that just helped to make the area a bit more popular for bakeries, cafes, small restaurants, an exhibition center.
That's Spiros Loukopoulos from Denmark. This real estate development around such places is something food hall consultant Philip Colicchio has also observed in the US.
We like to call that the halo effect that now produce revenue. And so if I've got those two stores, it's very likely that a retail store is going to look. It's likely that perhaps some small residential is going to be either acquired or improved. In commercial real estate, the halo effect means I can charge another dollar per square foot for office space.
Is there a risk then of this market becoming oversaturated?
As a general proposition, no. The food hall continues to evolve. We were just retained on an assignment that is going to be designed as a rock climbing wall and social club. And the developer is intent on creating a food hall within that environment.
That's Philip Colicchio, a food hall consultant from the US.
And that was Davina Gupta there, looking into the business of food halls. The one that she started a program in is just across the road from us here, I have to say. I do like to go there myself and have a little bit of food. I've been partial to it sometimes. That's it from World Business Report.
I'm Sumi Somaskander from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at Ukraine's surprise attack on Russian territory. Thousands of Russian residents have been forced to flee their homes as Ukrainian forces edge closer and closer into Russia. Could this bold gamble shift the dynamics of this war? Or could it backfire? The Global Story podcast brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.